Chapter 13. Enter the Special Branch. One afternoon early in February, I received a visit from the Special Branch. The visit was not unexpected, it being the result of a telephone call I had received that morning from Christmas Humphreys. The branch wanted to talk to someone in the Buddhist movement about Ananda Bodhi, and he had suggested that they should talk to me, as the person most likely to be able to help them with any inquiries. Would I be willing to see one of their people and tell him what I knew about Ananda Bodhi and his activities? As it seemed I did not really have much choice in the matter, I agreed, and thus it was that Detective Inspector Jin came to be sitting in my room at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara that February afternoon. In the event, I learnt much more about Ananda Bodhi from him than he, so far as I could tell, learned about the Canadian monk from me. He was, in fact, extremely communicative, even chatty, possibly in order to encourage communicativeness on my part. Ananda Bodhi had recently been in Scotland, so my visitor informed me, and while there he had given a talk to a Buddhist group. Whether or not this was the group that met at Johnstone House, the newly acquired mansion in Dumfriesshire, was unclear. In the course of this talk, he had spoken in such a way as to convince at least one member of the group, herself a Buddhist, that he was not a Buddhist monk at all, but a communist who, under the cloak of Buddhism, was engaged in propagating the gospel according to Marx and Lenin. Horrified, she had written to the Special Branch denouncing him and demanding an investigation. On their looking into the matter, Detective Inspector Jin continued, they had made the interesting discovery that Bhikkhu Ananda Bodhi was none other than their old friend Leslie Dawson, of whom they had lost track 4 or 5 years earlier when he suddenly, quote, disappeared. Now he was again under surveillance, it seemed, for Jin added that, according to reports they had received, he did not behave like a Buddhist monk. What this exactly meant, I thought it best not to inquire. Except for his disregard for monastic etiquette, I had witnessed no un-Bhikkhu-like behaviour on his part, nor had I ever heard him talk in a way that suggested he might be at heart a communist. But then, I had seen very little of him, and he had shown no sign of wanting to take me into his confidence, even to a small extent. There was only one circumstance that could be regarded as being at all suspicious. This, as I explained to my visitor, was the fact that he and two of his staunchest supporters, a youngish married couple based in the West Country, had first met in Moscow when the three of them were attending an international communist students' conference. A few days later, Mangala told me that the previous evening, while I was away at the Buddhist Society taking a meditation class, Ananda Bodhi had been to see him. In the course of the visit, he had declared, in his usual dramatic fashion, that he was now trying to, quote, tear people away from Buddhism, as it was, quote, too stultifying. How seriously were these words to be taken? Neither Mangalo nor I really knew. But if Ananda Bodhi had been indulging in that kind of talk in Scotland, and perhaps also giving expression to left-wing political views, it was not surprising that people should have started doubting his bona fides as a Buddhist monk, or have even become convinced, in the case of at least one person, that he was not a Buddhist monk at all, but a crypto-communist. Though I found it difficult to believe that the brash, controversial Canadian monk was truly a Buddhist, as distinct from being simply the purveyor of a mixture of insight meditation and psychotherapy, I found it no less difficult to believe that he was a paid-up member of the Communist Party, who had become a Buddhist monk in order to propagate the gospel according to Marx and Lenin under the cloak of Buddhism. The fact that he had first met two of his staunchest supporters in Moscow at an international students' conference did not really amount to much. Many young people went through a vaguely idealistic left-wing phase, and Ananda Bodhi, in his days as Leslie Dawson, may well have been one of these. At the same time, I could not ignore the fact that this troubled world of ours, halfway through the 60s, was still in the grip of the Cold War, with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe ranged on one side of the great ideological divide, and the United States and Western Europe on the other. 3 years earlier, the Cuban Missile Crisis had brought the world to the brink of nuclear war. But although Khrushchev had drawn back at the last minute, the Soviet Union had not yet awoken from its dream of a world dominated by totalitarian communism. As I knew from my own experience in India, its strategy included such activities as subsidizing fellow travelers, setting up front organizations, and infiltrating cultural bodies, not to mention government departments, trade unions, and the media. And it was not inconceivable that the British Buddhist movement, tiny as it was, had been thought worthy of the KGB's attentions. The Indian Buddhist movement had certainly been infiltrated, as had a section of the Theravadin monastic order in Ceylon. I could not, therefore, altogether rule out the possibility that Ananda Bodhi was in fact a crypto-communist, or at the very least, more of a communist than a Buddhist. Despite the Cold War and the fact that the British Buddhist movement might have been infiltrated by communists, I took little interest in politics. Least of all did I take interest in British party politics. I knew, of course, that there had been a change of government in the autumn, but I was no more enthused by Harold Wilson's talk of the white heat of technological revolution than I had been in India by Harold Macmillan's talk of Britain never having had it so good. But if I was not interested in British party politics, I was interested in the opportunity of meeting a British politician, especially one who was a famous journalist and author to boot. The politician was Tom Dryburgh, the Labour MP and future chairman of the Executive Committee of the Labour Party, with whose lively William Hickey column I had been familiar during the war. We met in the lobby of the House of Commons, the meeting having been arranged by Anna Phillips, who had once worked for him and who had told him that I liked his book, The Mystery of Moral Rearmament, a copy of which she had given me and was planning to review it in the Buddhist magazine. So far as Anna was aware, he knew little or nothing about Buddhism, but years later I discovered, on reading his autobiography, that he wished he had kept more of his parents' Indian curios, for instance, a Tibetan prayer wheel. At the time of our meeting, Dryburgh was a tall, well-preserved man of 60, with rugged features and a non-existent hairline. He received us with what was even then being described as old-fashioned courtesy. But when Anna, with misplaced flirtatiousness, attempted to rally him on his having neglected her for the last few months, he repressed her promptly and without mercy, and I perceived that there was a streak of brutality in his composition, and that he was not a man with whom it was wise to take liberties. Naturally, we talked about the book and about Dr. Frank Buchmann, the leader of the Moral Rearmament Movement, about whom my Bombay friend, Dr. Dinshaw Mehta, had often spoken to me. The American evangelist's ideas on divine guidance having influenced his own. As Dryburgh was well known for his championship of the underdog, I took the opportunity of telling him about the plight of the ex-untouchables, and about Dr. Embedkar's movement of mass conversion to Buddhism, as well as about the visit that B.K. Gaikwad, one of the political leaders of the New Buddhists, was proposing to make to England. Our host listened with what appeared to be genuine interest and sympathy, and expressed his willingness to help with newspaper publicity in connection with Gaikwad's visit. When the three of us had talked for half an hour, Dryburgh obtained passes and showed Anna and me to the Distinguished Strangers Gallery, where we spent the next half hour and more listening to the debate. We heard two short speeches, one by Quintin Hogg, the former Viscount Hailsham, and one by Anthony Crossland. Hogg was a Conservative and thus spoke from the opposition benches, and as the Distinguished Strangers Gallery faced these, we had a good view of him as he spoke.
He spoke extremely well, in the sense that his delivery was excellent and his language polished. What the debate was about, I no longer remember, if indeed I ever knew. Of Crossland's speech, I have no recollection whatever. But what drew my attention even more than the two speakers was the historic chamber itself. It was much smaller than I had expected it to be, and much more Gothic in style. Indeed, with its abundance of elaborately carved woodwork and heraldic reds and blues and golds, it looked less like the home of a modern legislative body than a royal chapel, which is what it was originally. As I looked round at the place and thought of all the great issues that had been debated there, it was as though the fretted roof still echoed with the oratory of Canning, Cobden and Bright, of Gladstone and Disraeli, of Lloyd George and Winston Churchill. Churchill had died the previous month, so it was not difficult to imagine that bulky, cigar-smoking figure rising to address an anxious house in the darkest days of the war. Happening to drive past the Parliament building on a grey January afternoon, I saw the long dark lines of mourners silently waiting to pay their last respects to the great man as he lay in state in Westminster Hall. At least, I think I saw them. Vividly as the picture of Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament in the gathering dusk, the lines of mourners, the drizzle, and the occasional black-caped policeman presents itself to my mind's eye. I may only have seen it in the newspaper the following day. Not that I was a great reader of newspapers. I sometimes looked at the Conservative Daily Telegraph, of which I had been a regular reader during the war, as well as at the weekly New Statesman, the left-wing house organ of the Hampstead intellectuals, and that was about all. In those days, the press hardly ever carried material of specifically Buddhist interest. When it did so, the item related, more often than not, to the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. In the weeks following my return to the country, I was in fact interviewed several times. One reporter from a popular women's magazine apparently thought that Buddhist monks were something to do with the Trappists. Was I allowed to speak to people, she asked, or to leave the Vihara? Another wanted to know who had sent me to England, as though somewhere in the East there was a central Buddhist authority, rather like the Pope, who sent out missionaries in all directions. But my most interesting encounter with the press came when I was interviewed by a journalist from a leading Scottish daily. He could not have spent more than half an hour with me, yet in his article, which appeared under a pseudonym, he described at length how he had asked if I would ordain him, how I had agreed, and how he had spent the weekend at the Vihara wearing the yellow robes and fasting and meditating. Apart from me, he informed his readers, he had seen nobody during that time, and the silence of the place had been uncanny.